Andy Show.
From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Kojo Namdi Show, connecting your neighborhood with the world. Summer reading season is upon us, and whether you're looking for a paperback to toss in your beach bag or titles to load onto your e-reader before a long flight, there are lots of new works of all styles and varieties to check out: novels, biography, poetry, and prose. And today, we've got a group of book lovers ready to bring us up to speed on what to be on the lookout for. Joining us in studio is Eileen McGurvey. She is the owner of One More Page Books. That's an independent bookstore in Arlington, Virginia. Eileen McGurvey, thank you for joining us.
Hi, Kojo. Thanks for inviting me.
Also in studio with us is John Wilwall. He's a freelance writer and member of the National Book Critics Circle. He's the regular book critic for Washingtonian Magazine. His work has also appeared in the New York Times Book Review, the Washington Post, NPR, and other places. John Wilwall, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Kojo.
And joining us from the studios of the Radio Foundation in New York City is Barbara Hofert. She is the editor of the Pre-Pub Alert for the Library Journal, which keeps librarians up to date on what's new in the publishing industry. Hi, Barbara. How's it going?
Good, and very glad to be back on the show.
Glad you're back with us. If you'd like to join the conversation also, 800-433-8850 is the number to call. What's the best book you've read in the last 6 months? Give us a call, or if there's a title you've been eagerly awaiting the release of, call us, 800-433-8850. You can send us a tweet at Kojo Show. Eileen, you've said that your customers don't necessarily come in looking for bestsellers, but there are a few titles out this month expected to be blockbusters. Are lots of people looking for the new Dan Brown and Khalid Hosseini novels?
That's true. It's not to say that they don't buy them, but they don't necessarily pick them up first thing when they walk into our store. Or if they do, they often walk out with other things, which we love.
Good for you.
But we try to give a different selection out there. So we try to have the blockbusters if people want those, but also we like to give a lot of space to new authors or to maybe from authors that people haven't run across before.
Barbara, this is Khalid Hosseini's third novel, looking likely to join the first two on the bestseller list. You say it hits his best yet. What's different about it?
The first two are wonderfully popularly written. I think they're great novels. The third one, I think, is actually a big step up in terms of his writing. And I've not read the whole thing. I've just entered into it. But I was immediately struck by his use of language, by his use of folkloric elements, and it called to mind another very favorite novel of mine of the last couple of years, Taya Obret's The Tiger's Wife, in how it uses folkloric elements to talk about larger issues. So I'm very excited to finish it, and I'd encourage a lot of people to look at it who might not have even been that familiar with or known The Kite Runner or been that taken with it. This is a book to look at.
Well, Khalid Hosseini's books helped a lot of readers feel more connected to the Middle East in general and Afghanistan in particular, Barbara. For those looking for further reading in that region, you recommend The Blind Man's Garden. What made it such a standout for you?
I particularly love this author. His first book that I read of his, The Wasted Vigil, not his first book, but the first I knew, I thought was amazing in not coming down black and white in terms of saying there were particular viewpoints that, you know, clearly pro-West, clearly pro-jihad, but showing how complex the Middle East is. And this particular novel is set as it starts in a garden behind the house of a man who's going blind. He is a humanist and a believer, once ran a school. The school is now taken over by a much more right-wing sort of director, and he has lost his wife. And now his son and foster son it's post 9/11, and they've crossed the border. They've gone up off simply as doctors because the young son is training to be a doctor. They have gone off to help victims on both sides in fighting, but they've come from Pakistan. They're heading to Afghanistan, but immediately are caught up in things they could not have imagined, and one has such a different sense and understanding, much deeper understanding, I think, of place and time and of a particular culture after reading Aslam's book. He emphasizes the idea of how we're all caught up in history and caught up in what's gone before. There's an image at the beginning of silk cotton trees that have bird snares in them. The birds are caught by the bird pardoner, who then, as soon as you release the bird that's caught, it's apparently you're given the forgiveness you're looking for. And sometimes our forgiveness isn't so easy to come by, but it's a wonderful, pervasive symbol for the book.
The Blind Man's Garden is what it's called. John, Eileen, earlier this week, author Stephen King announced that his next novel will be released as a physical book only, no e-version. And publishers report that the astronomical growth that they'd seen that they had been seeing in ebooks has started to even out. How do ebooks factor into what you do, John?
As a reviewer, I mean, I don't use ebooks too much. I don't own an e-reader. I still need the geography of a physical book, if that makes any sense. I find it very, very helpful when I'm going back through a book to sort of have a sense where certain plot sort of things happened and where certain characters said certain things. And so I still rely heavily on sort of the physical geography of a book to do that quickly and efficiently. I love the idea of having an e-reader to get through things like I would love to read Dan Brown's new thriller on an e-reader, you know, sort of just burn through it once. I'm also fortunate my commute is a walk. I walk to work. And I know that lots of people in the D.C. area sort of love to have their e-readers on the bus or on the metro and things like that. And so I'm not opposed to them, but I haven't used one yet.
Not a big e-reader at this point. How about you, Eileen?
I'm not a big e-reader either, but I always feel that whatever gets people to read is wonderful. Customers will come in and they'll kind of be a little bit embarrassed to tell us that they have an e-reader, and it's totally fine with me because most of them read books, physical books also. And to follow up on what John said, a lot of times they'll read something on their e-reader and then they'll come in to get the physical book because they want to be able to go back through it. And you know, mark different things in it that's easier.
They are,
with
like
book.
John, they're like navigating the contours, yeah, of the real book. In case you're just joining us, this is our summer reading conversation. We're inviting you to join it by calling 800-433-8850. Who or what do you rely on for reading recommendations? 800-433-8850. You can send us a tweet at Kojo Show or simply go to our website, kojoshow.org, where you will find a list of the books recommended by all of our panelists, including E. Ethelbert Miller, who couldn't join us today. That's at our website, kojoshow.org. Eileen, one title on many bestseller lists will already be familiar to lots of listeners, The Great Gatsby. It's my understanding there is a movie tie-in edition that's out, but some booksellers are refusing to stock it, sticking with the original cover art instead. What's on your shelves, and which copy is moving more?
Well, I'm laughing because this is something we go through every time a movie tie-in book comes out, and a lot of booksellers, like those folks in my store, are more parochial about it, and we like to stick with the traditional. We do have the movie tie-in version, and that's often the ones that, like, the kids will want, you know, or the young adults will go for that, whereas the older folks like me are more traditional.
Well, more broadly, cover art can play a role in people's decisions to pick up a book or not. Oftentimes, they're reimagined from hardcover to paperback and from one country to another. I'm curious to hear from each of you, starting with you, Barbara Hofert, about the importance of a book's cover.
You know, it can get you into a book. It certainly works, and even in libraries, the audience I serve, books are often turned out so that you can see the cover. It's funny, as a reviewer, they don't influence me that much because I'm going through galleys so fast, and I often find myself quite surprised when I see the final version of a book's cover. It's often because I'm gotten the covered galley, and you know, it's yellow or marked up, and here's this you know, often, sometimes to me, rather garish cover. I'm sometimes surprised. I think, you know, covers are important and they're part of it, but what fascinates me is how what works for one person doesn't for another, or how different covers can be from one country to another. I often meet with publicists who say, They're not using the English cover, thank goodness, because the English style is very different from ours. It's a more simple, folk-like almost kind of style that's very different from American style. And what works for British readers and obviously draws them in doesn't work for American readers. And it's fascinating how you think and you notice trends, for instance, in covers as well. I was on a panel about a year ago, and another person on the panel said, have you noticed all these covers lately coming out that are showing only the back of women's heads and necks? And I hadn't until now. I've collected sort of dozens, and suddenly that's the style. And I'm not sure what that says. You know, we're all turning away from the world and into the book or whatever. But you do notice trends, and then it changes. And finally, you just turn that cover, and you get into the content, and that's what matters.
Eileen, do you notice in the bookstore, do covers play a role in whether or not people select books?
They do, not necessarily whether they buy it, but certainly whether it prompts them to pick it up. And we also have noticed the trends of certain types of covers. What's interesting to us is when we have authors in the store, and covers and authors are a very hot topic, a hot item of debate, because often the book cover is not one that the author would have picked, and they're unhappy about it because they don't feel it represents the book. And I know it's a combination between marketing and the artistic side of it with the author, but it's an interesting discussion to hear them talk about what their vision of the book cover should have been.
Covers influence you, John?
Absolutely. Well, as a reviewer, not so much. Like Barbara said, oftentimes I'm not seeing the cover until the book comes out. The galleys usually arrive, and there's nothing to them at all. It's sort of just the title printed on the cover of a solid colored paper. Background and things like that. So, but as a book buyer, I am very guilty of buying, you know, you shouldn't judge a book based on its cover, but I'm very guilty of buying good books based on their covers.
And you have other influences in your life, it is my understanding, that are from the UK.
That's right.
Giving you a whole new perspective on covers.
Exactly. My wife is English, and I'm fortunate in that when I get books from them, I'm also often pretty excited to get the English cover, and I just had to send some books off to my father-in-law, and I had to kind of apologize to him, to say, you know, don't judge these books by their cover. They're much better than they look.
Tell us about the latest John le Carré novel, A Delicate Truth, because apparently the covers in the U.S. and the U.K. are significantly different.
Yeah, the U.S. cover, if memory serves, and Eileen or Barbara might be able to correct me a little bit, but it's got a very dark cover, it looks like the kind of thing that you would pick up in one of the, you know, in CVS or something like that. But the U.K. edition has this really, really lovely sort of gold dragonfly wing on it, you know, on a white background, and a really, really elegant sort of typeface and things like that. So I was fortunate to get that one as a gift recently.
Barbara, new authors might stand to benefit from a memorable cover, and you have a number of first-time novelists on your list. By the way, you can look at the list at our website, kojoshow.org. We've talked to one of them, Anthony Mara, about his book, A Constellation of Vital Phenomena. And I wonder, Barbara, what makes you sit up and take notice of a new author and who should be on our listeners' radar?
Now there's a question we could talk a whole time about if we really wanted to. I think the first thing and the most important thing about it is any writer is the language and whether you love the language. How many times do I think a story sounds so interesting or the historical setting is intriguing to me and then the language just falls flat? So I'm always looking for authors who have a special use of language. I'm also looking for authors who are really wanting to investigate ideas even as they're spinning a really good story for me. And I thought Anthony Mara was wonderful for drawing me into a world I don't know well, obviously, because having not been to Chechnya and having followed but not closely the fighting there, but I thought he did a wonderful job of letting us into the mind of characters trying to sort their way through that. And again, it's interesting, our reviewer compared that again to Taya Obrett's The Tiger's Wife, which I had mentioned earlier. I think people really sort of using certain elements just to try to understand their world and a world that we can't know. And it's such, I love books that introduce me to a world I can't know. I don't want to read about what I know about. I want to read about what I don't know about. So that's a perfect book. It's a perfect example of that.
Speaking of things that one doesn't know about, I've been reading reviews of the book The Golem and the Ginny, and it's my understanding that you interviewed Helene Wecker, who wrote that book.
She was a wonderful interview. It's interesting because she draws on her own background. She is Jewish. Her husband is Syrian, Christian background, and she blends the Jewish and Arab mythologies into one book incredibly effectively. It's set in 1890s New York with two fanciful creatures, you know, two creatures that aren't human, a golem, who a woman created actually to serve a man who dies on the trip over. She's about to be his wife, and so she's sort of lost without a master, you know, because the golem is supposed to have a master, and the genie is completely opposite, released from with a bit of polishing from a vessel, and then ready to sort of bang his way about New York, and very free spirited. So it's a perfect novel. It's both really. For me, I love the idea of really an interesting and different setting. I never knew there was a little Syria in New York in the 1890s, but there was. And a novel of ideas, because it's talking about free will versus determinism, free will versus responsibility, the likenesses and the differences of these two different cultures, and sort of what really makes you human, because these two creatures aren't, and they're trying to understand the human world. And by the way, speaking of covers, it has an absolutely gorgeous cover that the marketing people and the author both love. So I'll just let you say that. Okay, I'll finish with that.
Speaking of covers, here is Peggy in Potomac, Maryland. Peggy, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Oh, yes. I wanted to mention a book that turned into one of our family's favorites on a road trip. I picked it out purely because of the picture on the audiobook cassette box of a Tyrannosaurus, and it was called T-Rex and the Crater of Doom by Dr. Walter Alvarez. We listened to it all the way up to Vermont and back, and we found it beautifully written, very interesting, and it was written so well that we could all follow it and learn a lot about the geology and the Chicxulub crater.
And you couldn't tell that from the cover, but the impulse that you felt when you saw the cover turned out to be ultimately good judgment, huh?
Right. We thought our 14-year-old would like to learn more about dinosaurs, and we all learned so much more.
Thank you very much for your call. By the way, we will be doing our kids and young adult edition of Summer Reading during the course of the next month or so. And if you're interested in the interview that we did with Anthony Mara, that was on May 13th, you can go into our archives and find that. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we rejoin our conversation about summer reading and take your calls at 800-433-8850 or shoot us an email to kojo@wmu.org. I'm Kojo Namdi.
Good afternoon. It's 1:24. We want to let you know that coming up at 2 o'clock on Intersection, WAMU 88.5's HD Channel 3 and streaming at WAMU.org, it's NPR coverage of President Obama's speech at the National Defense University. Again, that's coming up at 2 o'clock on Intersection, our HD Channel 3, and it's streaming at WAMU.org.
At WAMU.org, we're featuring a searchable database that will let you research the correlations between campaign contributions to elected D.C. officials and subsidies granted by city officials to developments. There's also a visual interactive along with expanded stories that explain the connections at WAMU.org. Click on Deals for Developers. Explore the data, read the stories, and let us know of any interesting connections that you were able to spot. Send your thoughts to dcproject@wamu.org.
Support for WAMU 88.5 comes from EHLS at Georgetown University, committed to training native speakers of critical languages to be strong candidates for federal jobs, accepting applications for their 2014 program. EHLSprogram.org. From Dr. Richard Mendelson and Family Foot and Ankle Centers in Ashburn, Fairfax, and McLean, Virginia, providing podiatric services including Cariflex and Pedalase laser treatment for nail fungus. More at familyfootandankle.com.
WAMU 88.5 and Imagination Stage are offering the chance to win a family 4-pack of tickets to see the play The Magic Finger. Find out more information on our website, WAMU.org.
Welcome back to our summer reading conversation with John Wilwall. He is a freelance writer and member of the National Book Critics Circle. He's the regular book critic for Washingtonian Magazine. His work has also appeared in the New York Times Book Review, the Washington Post, NPR, and other places. Also joining us from the studios of the Radio Foundation in New York City is Barbara Hofert, editor of the Pre-Pub Alert for the Library Journal, which keeps librarians up to date on what's new in the publishing industry. In studio here in Washington with us is Eileen McGurvey. She is the owner of One More Page Books, an independent bookstore in Arlington, Virginia. John, in the realm of nonfiction, you recommend a biography of a man many of us are familiar with, mm-hmm. but few of us are likely to know much about. What might we learn about the man behind Ripley's Believe It or Not from A Curious Man?
We don't know much about, at least growing up, I was aware of Ripley, but I didn't know much about him, and that's because there hasn't been a biography written about him until now. So Neil Thompson's new biography, it's wonderful. It's for a couple of different reasons. Number one, Ripley's story is great. He's born in 1890. He's an awkward kid. He has terrible buck teeth, and Thompson sort of emphasizes that throughout the book. And he's got a stutter, but he can draw, and so he sort of starts to get some friends through that talent and things like that. He's also a very fine athlete, which figures into the book a little bit. When he's 18, his father dies, and he's forced to go out and make some money for the family. And he eventually figures out that he can make some money cartooning. So he gets a job in San Francisco as a cartoonist, works for some of the biggest papers out there. Then he makes his way to New York, where one of the New York newspapers sends him abroad. And he sends back sort of cartoons about what he sees and things like that. Then he starts covering sports, and he's a sports cartoonist. And when he's doing that, he starts a column called Champs and Chumps. And in that column, he sort of covers great athletic feats and things like that. But eventually he figures out that sports can't sustain the column. And so he starts looking for other things. And he starts writing about sort of the different sort of weird human achievements that come out. And that's sort of the start of his Believe It or Not thing. Eventually, he sort of figures out that some of the best publicity he can get is by lying to people. And by that, I mean...
That still holds today.
Yeah, I guess it is. What he would do is sort of put something out there that people would assume was untrue. And so one of the ones he was famous for was saying that Charles Lindbergh was not the first man to fly across the Atlantic. Of course, there was great uproar about this. There wasn't any real way for the public to fact check it. And so he would reveal a few days later that, in fact, you know, he wasn't the first man. There had been other... He's just the first man to do it solo. So, in fact, he'd sort of get people that way. But the thing I like about the book the most is the way that Thompson sort of describes how historical circumstances contributed to his success. World War I comes along, and it sort of turns all of the news stories into these stories in faraway places with exotic names, this great hunger for things that aren't familiar, for foreign things and things like that. And then when those soldiers come back from the war, they're all adrenaline junkies. And so there's a lot of interest in doing sort of these sort of interesting feats. You know, he covers this one Englishman who learns how to jump 13 feet backwards or something like that.
And then Ripley's been like a presence in certainly my life as far as I can remember. But yeah. It just occurred to me that I knew absolutely nothing about him.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I think that if memory serves, I think Neil Thompson says that he maybe read an obituary or saw a story in a newspaper somewhere and sort of got the idea for the story. Oh, no, one of Ripley's museums was opening up. One of his auditoriums, I think, was opening up in New York City. And Neil Thompson sort of did a quick Amazon search to figure out whether or not there had been a biography done, and there hadn't been. And so he went for it. And he really pulls it off nicely. I recommend the book strongly.
On to the phones again. Here's Bernard in Washington, D.C. Bernard, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to ask about, from the panel's vast experience, the best experience, has there been any study or maybe any anecdotal observations you may have had of a correlation between the gender or perceived gender of the author and the gender of the buyer, reader, or the audience of a novel? I mean, more specifically, I was wondering, do women prefer to read female authors of novels, such as ones that get categorized you know, for better or worse, in the romance section.
Well, I don't know if there have been any studies that have been done, but there's all kinds of anecdotal evidence. So I'll start with Barbara Hofert on that.
Yeah, and I'm trying to think of what I can say. I suspect that what I know of it is that in working in my own field that there are so many more women readers and they read so broadly that it doesn't I don't think that there's any actual great as great an impact as one might expect. I think one of the things that librarians worry about a lot is making sure that young boys keep reading and that they have enough material for men to read in their libraries, because men do tend to read more, both more in the thriller area and more in the nonfiction area in particular. So I know that there's always an effort to keep those shelves well stocked, but I think we have to be careful about not drawing too many lines about
readers. I was about to say, this is a loaded question, Irene.
I was going to say, I agree with Barbara on, I think it's probably less related to the author and more related to the type of book that it is. And for young boys and young men, there seems to be a bias towards the protagonist in the book. A lot of boys don't want to read a book that has a female protagonist, but girls seem to be willing to read both. But again, it's like I said, I think it's more related to the type of book that it is when we're older.
John?
Isn't it? And Barbara and Eileen, you could probably help me out with this. J.K. Rowling, wasn't she sort of told that young boys wouldn't read the Harry Potter series if she had gone by her first name? Do you guys know? I feel like I've read that somewhere.
It rings a bell somewhere.
It does ring a bell. And there's always that controversy with, you're right, with children, children's books in particular, the protagonists. And, you know, my daughter finally sort of got off the Harry Potter books because she actually really wanted a female protagonist. Mm. So that's interesting.
Hey, Bernard, thank you very much for your call. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes when it's hot outside, Eileen, you want to read a story that might send a shiver down your spine. What mysteries and thrillers are you especially excited about this summer?
Yo Nesbo has a few, actually, I think two new books coming out this summer, so I'm very much looking forward to reading them. And in addition to it being set up in Norway, it's also at Christmas time, so it's doubly cold up there. And I also, you know, reading mysteries and especially some of the Scandinavians and also Icelandic ones. The weather is a integral part of the story. It's kind of like a character in the story because it really does influence what's going on.
Yo Nesbo is called The Redeemer?
Yes.
And you're also recommending The Abomination by Jonathan Holt. Why?
You know, actually, that was a recommendation from one of our staff members. And, you know, it's set in Venice, and it's got a lot of undercover going on. It's a very intricate plot. It's got the Catholic Church and the United States military involved in as part of the plot. So there's a lot going on there in a beautiful setting.
How about you, John?
Thrillers-wise, the one that I put on my list was The Marseille Caper by Peter Mayall, which is decidedly not violent. Someone might get a knock on the head in a Peter Mayall book, but for the most part, no one gets killed or anything like that. It's the second book in the Sam Leavitt series, or Leavitt series. Sam Leavitt is an American who, in the first book, The Vintage Caper, helped a Hollywood producer steal back a case of vintage Bordeaux from a gentleman in Marseille. And in this edition, the gentleman that he stole the wine back from needs Sam's help to try to win a real estate contract. And it's great fun. If you haven't read Peter Mayall books before, they're great summer reads especially. They're set in the south of France. And in some ways, they're sort of vehicles to celebrate French cuisine and wine and French culture. And if that's your cup of tea, you really can't go wrong. They're great fun.
One of the mysteries that's been fascinating me for summer reading is Walter Mosley has brought back his character Easy Rollins in a new novel called Little Green. It picks up the story of Easy Rollins, who he introduced in Devil in a Blue Dress back in the 90s. And Easy Rollins was last seen in 2007's Blonde Faith, in which he had a drunken accident while he was driving and apparently died. And in one review I've read, Mosley said he thought that E.C. Rollins was dead too, which if you know Walter Mosley, you can believe he would believe that himself. Barbara Hofford, one of the books you're recommending this season, set in Somalia, has an air of mystery about it. Tell us about Submergence.
Okay. Submergence, the author's name is J.M. Lajard, and it's L-A-D-G-A-R-D. And he's actually born in the Shetlands, but has lived much of his adult life in Africa, covering Africa for The Economist. His character, his main character, James Moore, is a Nairobi-based Englishman who actually works for the Secret Service and is asked to go to Somalia to investigate possible al-Qaeda activity there, and is immediately jailed upon arrival and forced into a vermin-infested room and then marched to the unforgiving landscape. So he's a captive and really doesn't know whether he'll live or die. And as he's doing this, he's remembering, as this happening to him, he's remembering back to an affair he had at Christmas at a hotel on the northern coast of France, with a young woman who's a mathematician who applies her skills to the ocean, studying the ocean. And she, of course, it's all the submergence of our characters and how we connect comes throughout this very much novel of ideas, but also very absorbing novel. James has submerged his personality not once but twice, you know, sort of, and is denying who he is, and now he's lost. No one knows where he is. Danielle is about to submerge herself in the ocean, and you, as a reader, submerge yourself in the story, which really makes you think about. Are utopias, and do they last? Why did someone fight a jihad? Will we survive as a species? What is the importance of the laws of science? How will societies remake themselves in the future? I had an interesting talk with the author a couple of weeks ago who said he feels very strongly that Africa is the future. It's where we have to look to see what is going to happen to our world. So I think reading him gives you a sense of what some of the pieces are in a really satisfying way.
On to Beth in Springfield, Virginia. Beth, your turn.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. There's a new book out published in March that had an authored book talk at One More Page. His name is John Burgess, and he has written a wonderful, exciting, drama-filled historical novel about the court and the people during the building of Angkor Wat in Cambodia. But you don't have to have any connection to Southeast Asia to love this book, because this man is so skilled in his storytelling and so gentle in his presentation of history. It's just a wonderful read. At the moment, I think it's only available at Amazon.com, although One More Books may have some stock of it because he was just there. You could certainly call him.
I will certainly ask Eileen McGurphy, since she's sitting right here and might be able to tell us.
I was going
to
say, we usually keep at least one or two copies of that on hand.
And it's my understanding that author visits to the store tend to drive book sales a lot, don't they?
They do, and for a couple of reasons. First of all, the opportunity to hear the author brings people in, and I'd say probably at least half the people that come in for an author visit haven't been to the store before. They're there because it's interesting to them. But the other reason is it gets us all excited about the book. There's nothing like hearing an author talk about their book to get us passionate about it, and then we put it in a special place, and then we hand sell it to people. So.
Thank you very much for your call, Beth. We got an email from Ivetta, speaking of local authors, who writes, I would love to get the word out on a new local author, Mark Galeo, G-I-L-L-E-O. He has two great books out, Love Thy Neighbor is about a terrorist cell that comes to life in the Arlington area, inspired by real events. Sweat is about a politician and lobbyist involved in a sweatshop and a young man out to save a seamstress and set things right. Holly, we asked people to tweet about what they're reading for summer. Holly is reading Nosferatu, which is one of the books you were recommending, Eileen.
Yes, that was a book that I have not read this. It's by Joe Hill. He is the son of Stephen King. And several of our longtime customers were anxiously awaiting this book coming out. And in our store, when we have a book that somebody really likes, we put a little Post-it note on it. And this book is post-noteworthy. But you know, it is a thriller. It's a horror story. And one of the folks said they thought it was even better than his dad's writing.
Holly is also reading Bring Up the Bodies, Astray, The Master and Margarita, and anything else she can get her hands on. Irene is reading Room by Emma Donahue. Ghana Must Go, and The Great Gatsby. We're going to take a short break. You can also share what you're reading with us. You can send us a tweet at Kojo Show if you'd like to join the conversation. Is there a genre you tend to gravitate towards during the summer months? Tell us what and why. 800-433-8850. Or you can simply go to our website, kojoshow.org, see our panelists' recommendations, and make your comment there. I'm Kojo Nam.
Good afternoon. It's 1:42. Stay with us. Coming up just ahead at 2 o'clock on Intersection, WAMU 88.5's HD Channel 3 and streaming at WAMU.org. We'll have NPR coverage of President Obama's speech at the National Defense University. Again, that's coming up at 2 o'clock on Intersection, our HD Channel 3 and streaming at WAMU.org.
WAMU 88.5 and Lean and Hungry Theater invite you to a Summer of Love adaptation of Shakespeare's As You Like It, June 9th at American University's Woods Brown Amphitheater. After being banished from their wealthy homes, Celia and Rosalind hide out at a music festival full of peace, love, hippies, and rock stars, Sunday, June 9th. Doors open at 5. For tickets, go to wamu.org/events.
Support for WAMU 88.5 comes from the Rubenstein Family Foundation and the DC Public Library, dedicated to supporting summer reading for kids and teens. Students who read over the summer start school ready to learn. More at dclibrary.org. And from Trader Joe's, offering blueberry pomegranate green tea, using unsweetened green tea and natural blueberry and pomegranate flavors. Store locations at traderjoes.com.
Stay with us. Much more to come right here on WAMU 88.5, starting at 2 o'clock right here. Musician Pitbull talks about his new animated film, Epic. That's Tell Me More at 2 o'clock. Let's get back to the Kojo Namdi Show.
It's our summer reading conversation. We're joined in studio by Eileen McGurvey, the owner of One More Page Books. That's an independent bookstore in Arlington, Virginia. And John Wilwall, he's a freelance writer and member of the National Book Critics Circle. He's also the regular book critic for Washingtonian Magazine. Barbara Hofert is the editor of the pre-pub alert for the Library Journal, which keeps librarians up to date on what's new in the publishing industry. Barbara, we talked about Submergence, but you're also recommending two titles from young women who are part of the African diaspora here in the U.S. What might we learn from their novels?
I just like the idea that if Africa is indeed opening up and so important for the future, that we can connect with it through writers who are part of this diaspora. One of them, No Violet, Bula Weyo's We Need New Names, which just came out from Little Brown, is about a girl from Zimbabwe whose village has descended into chaos, whose family is scattered. She and her friends are scrounging for food on the streets, but she has a relative in America and is able to come to this country and stay here. And suddenly there's all this advertising on television about dieting at the same time that the refrigerator is more than full of food, and she's trying to understand how this all works out. My own reviewer said she thought it was the freshest voice that she's read recently in this whole African diaspora, and I think that it is an exciting new book to follow. Another one, the Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, and I apologize if my pronunciation wasn't good on that, but Americana, the main character here is a Nigerian expat, Princeton lecturer, posting acerbic comments on the website that really examine the continuing racism and the continuing questions we have about race relations in America from her distinctive perspective. I'm in the midst of both of those. I haven't finished them yet, but I think they're just incredibly strong, strong books to read now. And I'll just throw in one more person from the sure. diaspora because he's a favorite writer of mine. And I think he may have been on your show, Dinau Mengistu.
Oh, sure, yeah.
The Beautiful Things That Heaven Bears and How to Read the Air, two of my favorite novels. And I think they're all just incredibly wonderful writers that bridge us through to the whole world.
Because The Beautiful Ones was set in Washington, so it was really, I guess, for our listeners, a treat. But Dinau Mengistu, yes, he was on the broadcast. We'll tell you that date so you can go into our archives and check on that at some point. John Wilwell, October 18th, 2012, I'm reliably informed, is when Dinau Mengistu was on the broadcast. John, the temperature is already starting to rise. rise, and D.C. denizens know all too well that summer sometimes means days so hot you can't even muster the energy to read. To that end, you recommend a book with virtually no words. What will we find in Dimitri Martin's latest instead?
Point your face at the Dimitri Martin's a comedian. He's a New York comedian, and he's very, very clever. His latest book is called Point Your Face at This. His first book was called This Is a Book. Point Your Face at This is, as you said, it has almost no words in it. There's certainly no narrative. It's just a series of, I don't know, it's probably 250 pages long or so, and it's all cartoons. For those who liked Gary Larson's Far Side, it's sort of the same idea. You know, these aren't comic strips. It's sort of one cartoon and then another cartoon and another cartoon. And they're very, very funny and very, very clever. One that I really liked was, you know how people sometimes would, you know, there's this idea that if for a costume of a horse, you would have a guy in the front as the forelegs and a guy in the back as the hind legs. And in this, one of his cartoons is called Halloween Costume Miscommunication, and it's two horse hind quarters, I guess. and he also does interesting things like he does these sort of mathematical formulas. He has this fascination with taking things apart. And one of them is lip ring equals lip plus hole plus ring minus good judgment equals lip ring. So
Kojo,
that's very funny.
I was going to say we were fortunate to have Dimitri Martin come to our store for an event. He was on a book tour for this, and he would go to bookstores during the day, and then he would do his nightclub appearances at night. But his book is very clever, and sometimes you sit there and you have to look at it several times to figure out what they are, and then they're great.
Well, Eileen, you're also a fan of a graphic novel collection that has a third volume out next month. Tell us about the graphic canon from Ruskik.
This was something that I had never heard of before until one of our very smart buyers obviously bought it for the store. And once we got it in and looked at it, we were fascinated. Russ takes, you know, famous books that that we all would know, and he has commissioned different artists to do pictures of them and new interpretations of them. Sometimes he uses older art, but generally it's new. And it was kind of like a sleeper book for us in that I think people couldn't imagine what it was till they actually saw it. It's quite a big book, but it's just a great way of kind of melding, and they probably would hate this description, but melding like a graphic novel and literature.
So you would have things like the picture of Dorian Gray?
Yes.
That would be fascinating.
Reimagined by someone.
I can only imagine. Here is Alyssa in Arlington, Virginia. Alyssa, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, I'm so excited to speak with you all. I just had the privilege of being at an author visit with 300 elementary school students in Maryland, and the new author was Gary Carton. He wrote The Last Akaway, and everything you're saying today about keeping young boys reading and having a cover that draws children and adults to it, and it sounds like a great book, and that had got a great Kirkus review, and it's from Brattle Publishing. And Gary talked about growing up with a learning disability and always struggling with reading, and how special teachers in his lives that gave him different tools. He ended up becoming a sports writer for the Washington Post, and now just wrote this children's book. It was just an amazing story, and the kids were enthralled, and they ran over time, and it was just an amazing experience.
Oh, thank you very much for your call. Alyssa, as I said, we'll be having our kids and young adults reading broadcasts, you know, during the course of the next month. But you mentioned him being a sports writer for the Washington Post. So here now is Bill in Arlington, Virginia. Bill, your turn.
Hi, Kojo. I like sports, and I was wondering if Eileen could recommend any new sports books that are either well-written or popular.
Eileen.
Well, I was going to say, actually, I have one of those that I put on our list, and it's very specific to the Washington area. It's a book called Beltway Boys, and it's an insider's look at the Washington Nationals and about how they, you know, took their two phenoms, Steven Strasburg and Bryce Harper, and, you know, melded them with an experienced manager and their new team to come up with a really exciting team. The author is local, and he's going to actually be at our store in June talking about it, but we have a resident baseball fanatic on our staff, and she read it and loved it. So that would be a definite recommendation from us.
Also, we got a recommendation from E. Ethelbert Miller of a book called Baseball as a Road to God, Seeing Beyond the Game by John Sexton. So you might want to check that out. Barbara Hofert, last year we talked about the fact that the Pulitzer Committee chose not to award a prize for fiction. This year it went to Adam Johnson's novel, The Orphan Master's Son. How important is that award for authors, and what do you make of the pick?
Well, I think, first of all, I think everyone was relieved and also, well, of course, there's so much great writing. How could there be any question that many prizes or many books deserve a prize? What I liked about this book particularly was it's just astonishing that an American who's never lived in Korea, who's never in North Korea particularly, who's never lived under totalitarianism, who doesn't know what it's like to have grown up shaped by that kind of thinking, could introduce us so well to that world. As I said before, I'm always looking for books that are showing me something new and different. And I thought what he did was what fiction can do so well, really transporting me to another place, not by reporting, but through imagination. So I thought he did an amazing job, and I'm very pleased he won.
We got a tweet from Charlene, who says that she chooses books based on covers all the time. If the cover draws me in, I'll read the blurb and then the reviews on Goodreads. Great typeface intrigues me, too. Speaking of Goodreads, John and Eileen, another announcement that made waves in the book world a few months ago was the purchase of the website Goodreads, where avid readers share reviews by Amazon. What do you make of that move, John?
Eileen will probably have a little bit more to say about this than I do. I haven't used Goodreads a whole lot. But you know, Amazon, I think, is generally seen as coming into spaces where readers rule, right? So indie bookstores are being ruined by Amazon. Brick and mortar bookstores in general are being ruined by Amazon, and so here they come again into a place that I think readers had seen as a place that was maybe not affected by Amazon, and all of a sudden it's gone.
It's Amazon territory.
Yeah, it really upset a lot of people, I think, because, you know, they went to Goodreads, they talked about their books. It's really a reader's forum. And, you know, a lot of people that read a lot are very supportive of independent bookstores. And, you know, Amazon coming in and purchasing this, you know, it's definitely a smart move for them to give them a lot more review material to help in their recommendations. But again, it is kind of, you know, them encroaching in yet another area that made people feel defensive. Now, I don't know that people would necessarily stop using it, but it kind of soured them a little bit on it.
When we spoke last, Eileen, you had opened just 5 months earlier, and the future for independent bookstores was looking pretty uncertain. How are things going?
Things are going very well for us. We're lucky. You know, Washington is an area where people read a lot. The neighborhood that we're in, you know, people love to read. They support us, and they come in and, you know, tell us all the time how happy they are that we're here and that they come and buy our books there. I think, you know, what independent bookstores, you know, are doing to survive and to thrive is to, you know, to bring authors out to people so that they can talk with authors in person and to talk to other readers, too, because people who love to read love to talk about books and share them with other people.
And this is something that authors embrace.
They do. And I think, you know, it's tougher and tougher for authors to get the word out about their books. You know, the marketing budgets aren't there. And, you know, a lot of authors are on their own. And so what's interesting is some of them will, you know, plan these road trips across the country all by themselves. They'll take whatever little marketing money they have and kind of hop in their car and drive around and you know, to get the indie bookstores behind them, because we have our own community as well where we share information about books. And, you know, we have our own bestsellers list that, you know, sometimes overlaps with the New York Times, but you'll find a lot of different books on there also.
Here is Marty in Washington, D.C. Marty, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi. Thanks, everyone. I wanted to recommend a book of poetry because I think poetry is a wonderful genre for the summer, especially, you know, when one's on vacation and has the time to kind of relax and really interact with poetry that, you know, for some people can be somewhat difficult to access. The book is called Clangings. It's by a poet named Stephen Kramer. It's Kramer with a C. And the term clangings refers, it's a psychological term that refers to the kinds of specialized speech that's used by people with certain mental illnesses, schizophrenics, manic depressives, who have trouble expressing themselves using ordinary speech. And their language then becomes very poetic and rich with imagery.
And Kramer has taken this concept and written this book of poetry. There are 49 poems that kind of flow into a monologue of his main character. And it's a gorgeous book and very, very accessible.
Clanging by Stephen Kramer. Thank you for that recommendation. Barbara Hofert, you've got a selection of poetry you'd like to recommend. It sounds like an incredible group that you've got on the list.
Yeah, I was really happy with this particular group of poets and hope that everyone will be reading them all summer. Anne Carson's Red Dock, which is a sort of modern dress reconfiguring of Greek myth, picaresque tale. In her first autobiography of Red, Medusa's grandson Geryon, who was killed by Heracles, actually comes back as a kind of moony youth, and you see him going on and making his friendships and kind of a fascinating, as I said, picaresque tale among
only got about
young
a minute
people.
Left, but go ahead.
Okay, sorry. Juan Felipe Herrera's Senegal Taxi, Bob Hickok's Elegy Ode, and Carl Phillips's Silver Chest, all completely different books and all utterly engaging reads.
John, in the 30 seconds or so we have left, if listeners are hoping to pursue their own artistic endeavors this summer, they might draw inspiration from Daily Rituals by Mason Curry. What did you take away from that book?
I thought it was interesting. Daily Rituals, it sort of describes the artistic habits of 161 sort of creative legends and things like that. The thing that struck me is that he raises this question at the beginning of the book, how do we do meaningful creative work and still earn a living? And so I was struck by the idea that those two things don't
you get
necessarily
to see
come together.
The habits of all of these writers.
That's right.
John Wilwald, he's a freelance writer and member of the National Book Critics Circle. He's regular book critic for Washingtonian Magazine. John, thank you for joining us.
Of course, thank you.
Eileen McGurvey is the owner of One More Page Books. It's an independent bookstore in Arlington, Virginia. Eileen, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And Barbara Hofert, she is the editor of the Pre-Pub Alert for the Library Journal. That keeps librarians up to date on what's new in the publishing industry. Barbara Hofert, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, and you all stay cool in Washington.
We'll try our best. The weather seems to be getting cold again. Thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Nandi. Coming up tomorrow on the Politics Hour, revving up the engines. Virginia conservatives are fired up about Republican candidates for governor and lieutenant governor. Meanwhile, D.C. Councilmember Tommy Wells puts the pedal down and launches a mayoral campaign. He joins us in studio. The Politics Hour, tomorrow at noon on WAMU 88.5 and streaming at kojoshow.org. And for listeners in Ocean City, Maryland, it's Coastal Connection with Brian Russo.
We want to let you know WAMU 88.5.